Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, on the first episode of 2021. I'm not going to ask you how your New Year's Eve was, because most countries cancelled their celebrations, unfortunately. Anyway, this is the episode of January 6, 6 days in, and I haven't quite gotten used to typing 2021 just yet. But I think that's the struggle each year. I am recording the interview with this week's guest remotely. That's why you'll find out more about that later in this episode. The recording quality will unfortunately not be as great because I am not in my usual recording setting for that interview. But first, possible good news for 2021 for innovative mobility in Ireland. The Republic announced back in October that new rules for e-mobility were incoming this year and that e-scooters are going to be legalized. How exactly this will be implemented is yet to be seen. Throughout Europe, there are different rules for these e-scooters, first depending on how they're used, and secondly from a safety and regulatory perspective. So you have e-scooters that you can buy and use just as much as you use any vehicle. And then you have companies that offer short-term rentals, where you pick an e-scooter up in the city and then park once you've reached your destination. Some of these big players in that field are companies such as Bird and Lime, but depending on your city, there are many local offers for e-scooters. Different countries find different solutions for road use, so that's the question: where can you use your scooter and how can you drive it? I think it makes sense here to have a local approach. So for instance, if you're in a city such as Sofia, Bulgaria, the pavements are traditionally so large that e-scooters don't bother pedestrians, but in a city such as Amsterdam, e-scooters are better served with using the extensive bike lane network. I think Ireland has been very harsh with e-scooter users. In 2019, for instance, e-scooter users were fined for not having their scooters insured, even though there's no insurance in the Republic of Ireland that covers e-scooters. I think it's silly because most people are quicker on bicycles anyway and represent an equal safety risk on bikes, so why treat both of these vehicles differently? The conversation is similar in the UK, where there's no general legality to e-scooters, but they are trying it out in different cities. Here's the BBC reporting back in October.
The Transport Select Committee recommends with e-scooters there should be no riding on pavements, no driving license should be needed, and helmet use should be encouraged, but not compulsory. Rental trials of e-scooters are already happening in 6 towns in England. They were fast-tracked due to the pandemic. The government's keen to promote e-scooters as an alternative to public transport. But London's rental trial is still some way off. TfL is trying to coordinate the London boroughs, and there have been problems in other towns and cities.
The downsides are apparently that people are using them on pavements. So some members of parliament in the UK are suggesting that they should be geofenced so that it could be discovered when people are using them on pavements. I'm very skeptical towards this idea because anyone who uses geolocalization regularly knows it's not that precise. I think we'd be getting too many people in legal trouble for something that they haven't committed. I like that you won't need a driving license because increasingly people who live in cities don't have a driving license. And that's actually the point of getting an e-scooter in the first place. Also, I think it's important to underline that not everyone who you see using e-scooters on pavements have bad intentions. Sometimes the road situation is too dangerous, or sometimes they're first-time users. And it's simply safer to use them on the pavement than on busy streets. Guilty as charged, in my case, I think we should apply common sense here and not trying to overregulate people's behavior. So both privately owned scooters and rental scooters should be allowed on European streets. They help ease the traffic, they suggest an alternative to people getting around cities, and give more choices, particularly to people who don't drive a car. For more information about your city and the sharing economy in general, actually including the use of rental e-scooters, you can check out the Consumer Choice Center's Sharing Economy Index 2020. There you can find your city and compare it to others. The top three cities in our index were Tallinn, Vilnius, and Riga, so the Baltics leading there. The lowest ranked cities were The Hague, Athens, and this one hits home, Luxembourg City. Ew. Another topic then I wanted to address with you is lab-grown meat. This is an exciting alternative to traditional meat products for people who want a more environmentally friendly solution, or for those who want to stop eating meat for ethical reasons yet crave the taste of meat. Here's Wired explaining some of what is being done in lab meat creation.
But they assured us that this is actually meat. So how do companies grow it? First, technicians take a small amount of tissue from an animal, then filter it and isolate cells that they can grow. That means providing warmth and oxygen, as well as feeding them salts, sugars, and proteins, essentially tricking the cells into thinking that they're still inside their owner. The cells naturally replicate as they would inside the body, growing into something that looks more and more like food. But while they can grow muscle, fat, and connective tissue from these starter strains, the big challenge is building them in a way that recreates the meat you're used to.
Nobody's anywhere close to lab growing a steak. There's different types of muscle cells, connective tissue, bone, pockets that aggregate a lot of lipids and fat, and all of that plays into the texture, the taste, the aroma, the appearance, the functionality of something in a pan or on a grill. We're really far away from being able to create this matrix of different types of cells all doing their job.
Which is why you end up with something that looks more sloppy joe than sirloin.
You might have seen some of these fast food chains have already started selling these products. The name Impossible Burger and Beyond Meat come to mind. But Europe is lagging behind because of existing regulation. For once, we have legislation on genetic engineering that prevents some of the lab-grown meat from being sold. They are GMOs. Another hurdle in the way are this constant push for denomination rules. So what are denomination rules? You've seen all these products advertised or simply called soy milk, almond milk, or veggie burger, or vegan schnitzel, and so on. When some of these were introduced, they were good comedy material, actually. I mean, vegan schnitzel, it's in it inherently comedic because it's absurd. But we've all gotten used to it, and we don't think that it's an actual schnitzel. But no, said some of the EU people who pushed for rules that would ban the word veggie burger. Fortunately, that idea was struck down in the European Parliament in November. But the word soy milk or even calling something milk-like will not be allowed anymore under EU rules. So denomination rules didn't push the veggie burger from our shelves, but it certainly implied that there's a problem with these products in the broader conversation. I'm not saying you should be forced to have GMO foods as an only choice. If you don't want to consume products derived from genetic engineering, you don't have to. And actually, you don't even have to by the current market standards, because many lab-grown meat variants don't actually need genetic modification to make the meat. Here's TRT World reporting about lab-grown kebab meat in Turkey back in 2019.
Instead of using this pectoral bovine serum, we use a plant extract, which is endemic to Turkey. We are hoping to lower the price at least 60-fold, which means almost $50 instead of $3,000 per kilo.
At this point, I'm sure you're all thinking whether that lab-grown kebab we mentioned earlier is safe enough to consume.
It's as safe as our conventional meat that we are eating now. One thing is it is free of contamination. Clean meat production is not a genetically modified organism. We do not transfer any kind of gene or gene product to these muscle cells. We just mimic what is happening in a mother's uterus.
I think lab-grown meat answers many questions. This meat can compete with traditional meat production, and even answer some of the supply chain issues that we're having. I've tried some of them myself, and I think the right approach is there, and we should build on that. My goal is not to tell you that traditional meat is bad, I do eat it myself, but we should open the way for viable alternatives. In any way, enough on the lab-grown meat details, I will now move to the interview of this week. So I'll be talking to James Holland. He is a campaign and communications consultant based in Brussels who worked in the EU institutions for a decade until Britain's exit in 2019. He has written about European politics for CapEx, Reaction, and Brexit Central. So, James, I wanted to know about this more about this Brexit deal. From the 1st of January on, it's now already in force. You probably have a lot of thoughts about this new deal. How do you feel about the changes that are now active, a UK out of the European Union? How do you see the deal that was decided?
Well, it's been a long battle, and I think there's still a lot of emotions floating around at the moment. So you have to be careful when you're following the commentary on this. For some people, you know, it's a moment of great celebration. Finally, we're out of the EU. For others, it's the kind of culmination of the disaster that was the decision for people to vote to leave the EU. As usual, the truth is very much in the middle. There's some good bits to the deal, and there's some There's some worse bits to the deal. I think what you're seeing is that very much the technical people got involved. The politics was put aside and you know, great efforts were made to facilitate and keep trade flowing. And I think many aspects of the deal in terms of goods and customs have made a good effort to put these things in place. But there are some leftover problems. Obviously, there are increased barriers to trade, which, you know, as someone who supports free market ideas, I never like to see appear. But that is an inevitable consequence. Brexit was primarily about politics and democracy. And the fallout of that is that some businesses will have additional costs as you now have to cross borders between two separate, completely separate political entities. But I have to say that, I mean, people, it's a long text and people are still getting their heads around it. Some people are doing some very good work. The Institute for Government has done some good reports. So I think we'll learn a lot more. But I mean, straight away, I'm happy that the process is finalized. And that we're now able to move on. The deal has also permitted some transition phases after the 1st of January deadline that we've just gone past to allow some of the outstanding points to do with data in particular to be resolved in the months to come. So that's a good thing.
There were a lot of Remainers that have said, well, a lot of damage is already done. Some businesses have left the UK. This has been a very long process to Brexit. It's of course difficult to draw any conclusions this quickly, or even though, I mean, this quickly, at least, you know, it's been already 4 years. Are you still the way you voted? And I know that you support Brexit. Would you still vote the same way? Or do you think something about the process could have been done very differently to avoid some of the consequences?
Yeah, hindsight is always great later to have tried to avoid it, some of the blocks that we had and the holdups and the kind of very public fights. But I think this is Britain leaving the EU is a huge thing. It's one of the most important political developments in recent years, especially in Western Europe and potentially, you know, the West, if you can still use that term more broadly. And this was always going to cause a lot of resentment and a lot of disagreements, because a lot of things have become set in their ways. You know, Britain had been a member of the EU for over 40 years. And in that sense, the legal profession, the civil service, the diplomatic services of both sides of the channel had very much got used to working together. And the idea of breaking that up after so many years was very shocking for people. And the reaction was one of fear, that not necessarily just fear, but also all the work that had been put in by these people to develop common rules and common standards could be lost completely. I think this trade deal shows that isn't the case. That's why I welcome it. And I think that we probably had to go through this extended process, this difficult process, to finally get to an agreement. And I think we also had to deal with the attempt to cancel Brexit, to cancel the vote, to reverse the decision. I think that was many people believe that if they could continue to attack the vote and to lambast, you know, aspects of it, they would be able to change public opinion, that a new prime minister would be put in place who would say, sorry, we've made a grave mistake and let's cancel it. Once that was finally defeated, when Boris Johnson won the election at the end of 2019, then I think, you know, you could get down to the detail, and the people who really understood cross-border trade, customs and things like this could get to work and find a good deal. But I think that's a process we had to go through. So the length of time and the difficulty, I think, was an inevitable consequence.
I was recently, for a different media outlet that I do some work with, I was interviewing Jean-Claude Juncker, and Jean-Claude Juncker told me that the problem of the Brits has always been in the European Union, that they were only in it for economic reasons, and they were in no way, shape or form attached to any political idea of Europe. Well, first of all, is that true? And what cooperation with the European Union should continue to exist beyond what is a trade relationship?
I think he's right. I mean, Jean-Claude Juncker has a lot of experience of seeing how the EU and Britain have had their relationship over all the years. And so I would say he's got that about right. Britain only joined for economic reasons. Britain was the sick man of Europe, was suffering, had just got to learn from the IMF. You know, Britain in the 70s was not in a good place economically. And the EU, or what was then the European Community, seemed like the kind of low-hanging solution to their problems. So it didn't join the EU when it was conceived more as a political project, as an attempt to stop German Franco conflicts that have plagued the continent for years. So I think that there was very much this perception in Britain that this was an economic boost to Britain's global standing and relationships and trading relationships. And as the EU pushed on with the more political aspects of the project, the relationship became worse and worse. You know, when David Cameron rejected the attempts to deepen Eurozone and to provide greater support for struggling economies, when he rejected that, the EU just pursued that with Britain excluded. They did a kind of treaty just outside of the EU just to push on with the project. And then when Cameron requested alterations to Britain's relationship with the EU before the referendum, those were pretty much, you know, rejected completely. There were some small concessions made, but nothing near to what David Cameron needed to secure a yes vote at the subsequent referendum. So I think, yes, I think the economics has always trumped the politics from the British point of view. And that bodes well for the future now, because the politics has been removed and the focus can be solely on the economics and making sure that trade is as free as possible. And that both sides learn from each other. You know, the EU will develop new regulations that Britain can copy if they're good and ignore if they're bad. And the same will happen in London. London will be smaller and be able to move faster. And good policies, especially if they're working together at the international level, will, you know, kind of improve both sides. So that competition in regulation is can be a good thing as well.
I absolutely agree. We here at the CCC, we are interested in creating a market that's more interesting for consumers to try and find innovative products. And very often EU regulation works against that. But of course, we want to hold the UK's feet to the fire when it comes to actually providing these opportunities. So when it comes to the new possibilities that the UK now has outside of the European Union, for instance, when it comes to genetic engineering and agriculture, or when it comes to, you know, just getting rid of a lot of burdensome rules and reducing certain tax rates that had been increased by the European Union, how confident are you that for the foreseeable future this will be the case? And you could, for instance, say, or for Boris Johnson, this is certainly the case. But of course, we also know that you know, in the past, Jeremy Corbyn, he has said, well, the European Union has prevented us from nationalizing rail services. This is something where the EU is actually good at. So how do you see this going forward? Of course, you don't. It's difficult to see the future. But with these opportunities now at hand, how much do you think will be seized by Westminster?
Yeah, well, this is the beauty of Brexit. This is why I supported it, is that the democracy becomes once again representative. And this means that as much as my personal views might want the, you know, the UK to liberalize and to increase competition in regulation and in goods and services, that may not be the case. Once again, it's up to the British people and up to politicians to propose manifestos and run campaigns that get them elected. So this is why democracy is what we believe in, but we understand that, you know, as it may not mirror our personal preferences. I believe that, you know, a smaller government such as the UK when compared to the EU is able to regulate faster, and the global economy now is such a fast moving thing. Innovations, especially in data and technology and services, are so fast that a government that can adapt quickly and permit these innovative industries to flourish within a strong legal and financial structure like the UK, there are big benefits. But again, I mean, if those things are done badly and the policies don't work and instead harm the UK economy, then an opposition party can take power and reverse that. So this is really a kind of kick in the backside, if you like, of British politicians who now really need to fight for their ideas and to make sure that they can convince the public that their, you know, their vision is the better one. They can no longer hide behind Brussels, who will pursue a, you know, quasi kind of neoliberal campaign of freeing up markets and increasing access, but at the same time protecting large vested interests in certain sectors where you just simply can't touch them. It's a real kind of new age for democracy in Britain. I'm very interested to see what happens in the coming years.
as I think as everyone on the continent, I'm also interested, not sure how much you can speak to that at this point, but you know, something I do enjoy about the European Union quite a bit. I'm from a small country, Luxembourg, and you know, crossing a border is something you do if you drive half an hour into every direction. When I go to the UK, it all seemed always very complicated. You know, you take the Eurostar, and there's quite a few checks and passport checks and all of that. Are we going to see more of that? Is it going to be even more difficult to be a traveler going to the UK? Am I going to have to deal with more bureaucracy now? How do you think that will be played out? And if there are any hiccups, do you think there will be the political will to do changes?
Well, yeah, I mean, clearly there are going to be more checks, but Britain was never in Schengen. So you already needed, you know, you didn't have that kind of ease of cross-border movement that you did if you're crossing from Luxembourg into Belgium or something like that. You did get checked at a border, as you know, if you've taken the Eurostar from Brussels or Paris to London. But there are customs checks now on goods, so that you will need to declare your trade. So there are clearly going to be more checks. But I think that there is this desire on both sides to keep people moving and to keep goods moving at the moment. Now, the Brexit vote was won on the back of taking control of borders. That's often seen by critics of the vote, rather the referendum result, as the people wanting to stop immigration. That isn't the case. And that isn't certainly not what the British government's been saying since the vote. There is a desire for immigration. It's just to make sure that it's the right kind of immigration for the British economy. So there will be brakes put on, you know, anybody from Europe wanting to go and live and work in the UK. So that will be a change. And I think that this is also a key area of debate between the political parties about exactly what levels of immigration are correct and what kind of immigration are correct for the British economy, to make sure that all sectors are, you know, have the staff that they need, have the employees that they need, but also that you're not hurting certain communities who have struggled, and you know, those communities that very much supported Brexit, who felt as if they were being left behind. And I think you're hearing a lot of that kind of rhetoric from the Boris Johnson government at the moment.
And that concludes this episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening. Make sure to follow the Consumer Choice Center on Instagram. We have updated graphics, consumer information, and as soon as we're back to travel, faces that will be presentable and representing you at conferences around the globe. Thank you so much for listening. I'm your host, Bill Woods. See you Thursday. You have to learn to pace yourself. Pressure. You're just like everyone.